Jeff Hacker and Rick DeLuia have been champions of automotive snipe hunting for the past many years, bringing back to life dozens of rare and historically interesting cars that most enthusiasts either never knew existed or had written off as extinct. They're particularly focusing on fiberglass cars, and that is the subject of our show today, Fiberglass. And Jeff and his partner Rick have a website called Forgotten Fiberglass. Jeff Hacker's our guest right now. Jeff, welcome into the Classic Car Garage.
Thank you very much. It's great to talk to you and meet you and look forward to participating.
Well, it's great to have you. Jeff, when most Americans think about fiberglass cars, of course, we think about the Corvette. The Corvette came on the scene in 1953 in America, and some people may think that that was the only fiberglass car in production in 1953, but that's not exactly right. How many cars did manufacturers have out on the road in 1953 that were actually made of fiberglass?
Well, that's the exciting thing. It was a cottage industry. I mean, fiberglass allowed people to build things in very small quantities, labor-intensive in some ways, you know, you couldn't, not volume production, but labor-intensive, but something you could do in a small shop if you had talent, skill, and tenacity. In 1953, Corvette debuted in January in the Waldorf at a show in New York. And by the fall, you could buy them in limited quantities if you were a special customer in the fall of 53. And I like to kind of share that with people because by the fall of 53, there were over 50 different manufacturers that were
wow.
producing cars, small quantities that were in steel, that were in aluminum, and mostly fiberglass. And I was just looking at some names here. Just in 53, some of the names were the Detroiter, mm-hmm. the Glaspar, the Victrus, Woodhill Wildfire, Fibersport in Illinois, and Meteor in Compton, Los Angeles, California. Misano, a gentleman is still around and with us today. He was producing a car in Pennsylvania and so on. Now, there could be many more, but just about 50, maybe a little bit more.
Now, it sounds like most of these cars, you know, when you talk about the Detroiter, these were actually American manufacturers, were they not?
Exclusively, the ones I just mentioned. And in fact, we track other ones, but since you mentioned to your listeners about our focus on fiberglass, that's absolutely right. And fiberglass was really introduced to the American public for cars at the Peterson Publishing, or Peterson Motorama, in November 1951, where a car called the Glaspar,
yes.
the Lancer, a Wasp, and Scorpion, those four cars in fiberglass debuted. And from there, that I often call that the Big Bang Boom. Then fiberglass cars exploded in 52, even on the racing circuit, there were a few, less than 12 months later.
Also, when you think about fiberglass cars, people think of kit cars. You know, Bruce Myers with the Myers Manx and those dune buggies back in the 60s. When did the whole fiberglass boom really sort of take off? Did kit cars really help bring attention to fiberglass bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. And kit cars, often by even the guys who have them today or don't like to call them, they're component cars and so forth. I embrace all languages and all ways of describing them because in the 1950s, building your own car in a kit was not what we would think today. You know, kits today are just wonderful.
Yes.
Everything is machined down to what you need or what you need to buy. A kit in 1953 or 52 was a fiberglass body, most often didn't come with doors or a trunk or hood. And you'd say, well, where do I want to put one? And so you'd get your saw out, or if you had some little extra money, pay for them to do that ahead of time, and then you had a body with doors or a hood. And then you had to put in floors, and then you had to wire it, and you had to get a chassis that was the right size and so forth. All those things had to be done by the person who bought that body, bought that component. And the average time it took, no matter what you read by enterprising and energetic sellers back in the day, Woody Woodall and so forth, the average one took close to 2,000 hours to build.
Wow.
So that's either the worst design kit or something different was going on. And in the 50s, what was different going on is that a kit was really equivalent to a component. So if you're going to build a car, you decided, well, do I want a custom body built by an aluminum or steel, or do I want something on a fiberglass? And then you decided what chassis you'd want, which often you'd have to modify a Ford chassis. People did create chassis that you could purchase. Mameco and other companies did in small quantities. And then you could also have someone like Frank Curtis build you a chassis. And all those added to the cost, but it really allowed you to create a specific kind of car for yourself.
Right, and I'm going to correct myself here a little bit. I really should have said replicas. I mean, that's the more socially accepted term for the cars and probably a better description of the cars that are available today.
Actually, it's good you brought it up. It's the wrong description. In the 60s, your cars, your fiberglass cars, were often what we call, I call it the age of the clones, where you had MGTD replicas and you had
right.
GT40 replicas and so forth. There's only one car in the 50s that I'm aware of that's not an original design. It's made out of fiberglass. In the 50s, these cars like Glaspar, Woodhill, Grantham, Stardust, Meteor, Byers, they were all of original design.
Mm-hmm.
And when you drove those cars, you drove that mark. And there were factory cars, and those companies could build them and so forth, too. But you didn't get a clone. I want a car like. There weren't clones of the Corvette, for example, in the 50s. They made parts for them. You could buy parts for them, you know, from a third party. But the clone side, Jeff, was actually stuff in the 60s and 70s. And now when we think of kits, we think we want to drive something very much in the spirit of.
Right.
And that wasn't. The Vale, these were just a couple cars that were exact copies, two, the Vale and a car called the Allied. And every single other mark was original design, and that's never happened again in our cottage industry of building cars in America.
There's a great event at Knott's Berry Farm in California, and I was there some years ago, and that was interesting because there was this conflict going on about replicars versus kit cars, and for the people who had the replicars, such as the Shelby Cobras and the Mercedes-Benz replicas and things, kit car was a dirty word. I've never known. Is it a kit car? Is it a replicar? So I think you've made a very good distinction there.
I haven't paid too much attention. I've been looking to try to accurately describe the amount of effort it took to build a car from the 50s or 40s, which is what really Forgotten Fiberglass, our website and our whole enterprise, is all about. Forgotten Fiberglass focuses mostly on fiberglass cars, but if you were to really look at it and define what we do on our website with Rick DeLuy and all the different folks who help, really we are chronicling the age of handcrafted, hand-built cars in America from the post-war years to about 1960, 65. After that is really kind of neat, but most of it is just clones, like we just mentioned, Jeff. But prior to that, if you and I wanted to build a car, we would start out, we might even design our own. And the average time it took back then to design and build your own body was about 1,000 hours. 2,000 hours is the time it took generally, as written back in the day, to build a car. And to give you an idea of an effort is 2,000 hours, if you're from human resources, you know that's 50 weeks
right.
of 40-hour weeks with 2 weeks off because you deserve it. So 1,000 hours, I'll give you a great example. A gentleman is a good friend, and I'm honored to have him as part of our group, Jules J. Hunan. He's the chairman emeritus of Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's known for his Hispano Suizos and other cars that I can't pronounce. They are wonderful, high-level cars that you appreciate, and I would in every way. But he was known in the 50s for building his own car, and he built it from scratch, and he got it fiberglass, he and his brother Cy. He's, like I said, part of our group, and I asked him, I showed him some of the comparisons, and we looked at what it took on his part to build a car, and I said, it's about 2,000 hours, right? I always like to kind of fact-check myself across many different people.
Right.
And he said, well, 2,000 hours, but I had to build my own body. It was closer to 3,000 hours. That's a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't done anything in my life for 3,000 hours.
Yeah, I mean, this is a labor-intensive hobby. It's really a labor-intensive thing to get into, so if you don't have patience, don't get into doing this.
Well, yes and no. Your listeners may be interested. I mean, the cars from the 50s were devoid of chrome, the handcrafted cars. They were devoid of heaters, air conditioners, roll-up windows, power windows. When you're talking about, I went and bought a kit to do one of our first ones, like painless wiring, one of the wiring kits that you buy for them. And I had to send it back because we had headlights, brake lights, dash lights, you know, your engine, that's it, with four circuits, and I think we combined this. There's not much to these cars, which make them wonderful restoration candidates. Absolutely. They're very honest sports cars. They're built at a time where if you could build it yourself using components that you get out of a junkyard, Ford frames, single axles, like a buggy spring, you know, very basic stuff, or maybe from 49 newer, Ford independent front suspension, Henry J, whatever you want to use. You know, these are very honest cars. They're not sophisticated cars, just like the Corvette was. Straight axle, I think, until the late 50s, maybe a little bit later. But they all drove like trucks, just like the Corvette. We used to have a 57 Corvette. I used to say it drove like a truck, and that's what these cars drive like. Very tough, very honest.
Jeff, one of the interesting things that you do is uncover lost cars. I know that you've worked diligently to uncover the lost history of cars found, and you've identified a lot of notable cars, and you've reconnected them with their owners. Tell me about some of the more famous cars and some of the more interesting cars that you have uncovered that were previously lost.
Absolutely. I was working with Denny Larson. Denny, he's since passed away, a very good friend. He was in his 90s, when he passed away. And Denny was involved in building a car called the Victorist. Now, Victorist bodies you could buy. They made about 100 S1As. And the car that he built and was famous for was the guy May Be Special. He built it with Ray Brown. Both were big names back in the 50s. And their Victorist, owned by Guy Maybe in Midland, Texas, set the fastest world's record for fastest open sports car in 1953, just over 200 miles an hour. Now, that car had been found, but I'm telling you that because I got to know Denny and we were talking, and he had kept this car years ago, many moons ago, and he told me it's aluminum and so forth, and we looked at it. And we made arrangements over a few years to buy the car and bring it home, and when I picked it up, it looked like a Cheetah. I thought, this is a strange thing, an aluminum Cheetah. And with a little bit of research, we found out that it was Bill Stropp's last race car, which Bill Stropp was a famous racer and builder in the 50s and 60s, and his son Willie is still around with us. And Bill was building one last race car for him in the early 60s, and then they stopped building it. You know, chassis was there, engine was there, everything's there. And they said, well, who was building it? He said, well, Don Edmonds and Bill Thomas, they were working in there. This was actually a car called the Beer Cage, and it was the prototype for the Cheetah, all in aluminum. So Cheetah, for anyone who likes the Cheetah sports cars by Bill Thomas, is actually based on an even more radical and aggressive-looking aluminum car that Rick DeLuy I found and brought home a number of years ago. People have been looking for a car called the Curtis Omohundro Comet, built in 1947. It was the first publicly available sports car. They built two, one in 47 and one in 48. Frank Curtis was involved and a guy named Paul Omohundro. People gave up looking for those years ago. We found one, and I was actually kind of frightened to start looking for the other one. And we were able to find that with a funny story from a good friend, Denise Sheldon, up in Livonia, Michigan. I was just up there to see my friends up there, including Denise. And she helped us find the second one. So they made two. They're both gone for 50 years. We now own both of them, brought them back home. And the first one has been on Jay Leno's garage once or twice. And it's a beautiful aluminum coach-built car. Another one that I found that was pretty easy to find, I used Tom Cotter's. Are you familiar with
Dave? Yes, absolutely.
Book, Cobra in the Barn, not Corvette, Cobra in the Barn.
Cobra in the Barn. I actually wrote a chapter in that book. It was the State Pen Corvette.
Fantastic. Well, that was my first barn find. 2006, I bought the book. What a terrific book, and people like you authored fantastic stories. And just as a note, everything we do started in long term, it started back in high school. But when we started turning on the gas and looking for cars and history and so forth, it all started in 2006. And we have a car called the Shark. I just found a Shark Coupe. It was made in 61, famous car in Hot Rod, Motor Trend, Road and Track. Road and Track in 66 identified it as the most streamlined car in the world, all underband and all. Real futuristic looking car. And I'm looking through Cobra in the Barn, and I see the story about the Moon Transporter, which looks futuristic and wild looking. It's a transporter for race cars that was built back in the 60s. And through Tom Cotter's help, that barn find was not a barn find, it was a book find.
Mm-hmm.
But I became good friends with the owner, Jim Degman, and we now own that car here too. But we've got streamliners, two of the really rare streamlined cars in the 1930s that were hand-built teardrop cars like the Dymaxion. Not the Dymaxion, but other cars like that. Big fuselage shape or teardrop shaped aluminum cars that we found. And we're restoring one of those two so far. We've got a few concept cars from Motoramas that were not GM Motoramas, but GM Motoramas were just as big as Peterson Motoramas and other Motoramas in the country. What most people forget is that we were left with these wonderful memories of General Motors Motoramas. Well, those cars appeared elsewhere in other Motoramas, in Indianapolis and New York City and Miami and Los Angeles. And they were televised events and fantastic movie stars appeared. And they didn't just appear. General Motors cars weren't the only ones there appearing. And we've got several cars, 5 or 10 different concept cars that we found over the years, from the McCormick, which was a 1955 concept car from the Peterson Motorama, to a new one I pulled out of a field in Pebble Beach area, Napa Valley, was the La Sieta, which was the show car from the Detroit Motorama. It wasn't called Motorama. It had another name in 1952, which was the earliest car up in Detroit. We found that one. On the way to Pebble Beach, we took 4 days and went out and rescued that car from a field.
Jeff, I had this wild idea, and I think you said you've actually done this, is looking through old magazines and old publications for cars that used to be for sale 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Have you ever had success in calling those ads and finding people who never sold the car and still have it?
Yeah, in fact, you and I wouldn't be the first people to do that. You know, there are people older and smarter and younger and smarter, at least from way that more so than me. But they're calling about what cars? They're calling in the back and they look and search for the Ferraris, the Duesenbergs, the Maseratis, all the ones they should do. You know, I like to tell people that I specialize in finding cars no one's looking for, which is kind of a double entendre because no one's looking for them because no one's really written up the history, which is the mission for our website, to share that with everyone. But the other reason no one's looking for them is they don't even know what to look for or what they are. And so we started calling about 5 years ago. We've started tracking Glaspars, Meteors, Grantham Stardusts, Allides, all sorts of really neat cars that they made 10 of, 20 of, 30 of. And we started looking not for the cars, didn't even think they would be around. But if you've got a person whose name is John Smith, I can't find him. But if his name is Jeff Shade, probably better. That's not a common name as much. And so most people don't have John Smith names, thank God.
Yes.
And we started tracking down people, and we got wonderful photos and wonderful histories, and these guys hadn't talked about their cars in 50 years, and their attitude, both things that we'll publish in the future and things that we already had on our website. And then a funny thing started happening, and we started finding their cars. And it's been less than 24 hours. We just got home at 5 a.m. yesterday. It was a five-year project. 5 years ago, I called and tracked down this person, and I was talking to him about his Allied, and he said, "Do you have any photos? Do you have any stories?" "Sure, I have photos. Happy to help and stories and tell me about the car he had back in 1957. It was for sale in 57. I said, "Well, do you have any photos of the engine?" And he said, "Well, no, but I can get some." I said, "Well, do you mean your friend has them?" He goes, "No, I still have the car. It's right there in the garage where it's advertised." So we just came back, built a good friendship with him, and I'm honored to say that he chose us to be the next caretaker purchaser of the car. It hasn't been touched in 57 years, if that's the right math, 1957.
Wow.
And in fact, if you read the ad and you called him in Ohio, there's the ad, there's his name, there's his address. That hasn't changed. There's the car. If you
put
a peek in the garage, there it was. And it's an Allied Cisitalia Swallow, which is a exact replica of a 1947 Cisitalia 202 Coupe, which is one of the most famous designs of the post-war era. And it's silver and beautiful red leather interior and dusty and dirty and up on blocks for 50-some years. And we're going to be showing that car, it looks like, at the February 22nd Boca Raton Concours d'Elegance here on 2015.
Well, that's a great story. area, Jeff, and I would imagine that there are many more like that on the website, ForgottenFiberglass.com, and I encourage everybody to go there and check that out. Jeff, I hope you'll come back with us on our show again soon and talk more about these Forgotten Fiberglass classics out there. But I appreciate your time today, especially since you're just barely back from a long trip like that.
Oh, I'm honored at any time. I'm happy to participate. Just let me know when.
That's Jeff Hacker. Once again, check out the website, ForgottenFiberglass.com, and allow yourself plenty of time because there is a lot to see.